Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer of The World. Often when you think of The World, you might first think about the voices and the reporting you hear on air. It's essential journalism that connects you and helps you understand the world around you. But there is so much more that is going on behind the scenes to make this show work. That means producers, editors, engineers, our whole studio team, all working together to bring you the best journalism with the highest production values. Our team has to be nimble, responsive, and rely on deep experience to make sure the news program you hear each weekday afternoon is the best it can be. We do this work for you. And actually, we can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal now through December 31st to raise $67,000 to support our nonprofit newsroom. And we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism is already reason enough to give. But here's one more incentive. A generous donor will match your donation one for one. Consider making a gift of $250 to The World. And our newsroom will receive $500 thanks to you and the power of teamwork. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Your gift makes all the difference. And now, here's the show.
The war in Gaza and Israel is taking a devastating toll on children. A whole generation is being traumatized.
Fear of darkness, flashbacks, nightmares, some kids even, and they are, we're talking about even like 15 and 16 years old.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, Russian President Vladimir Putin grew up in Soviet times, where the tough rules of the playground shaped who he is today.
These rules, based on physical dominance, on fierce loyalty, this was how they came to understand human nature and human relationships.
And the British Parliament kicked off a new session today with the King himself presiding.
I pray that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your councils.
The King's speech, though, is not actually written by the King. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. 1 month ago, Hamas carried out attacks and atrocities in southern Israel. It took a few days for a full picture of the death and destruction to emerge, but October 7th became the deadliest day in history for Jews since the Holocaust. 1,400 people were killed. Today, across Israel, memorials, this one at the Western Wall in the Old City of Jerusalem. Jews prayed for the safety of the 240 people being held hostage by Hamas and prayed for the memory of the dead. 1 month ago, as the sun set on October 7th, Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, told the nation what would come next. We are at war, Netanyahu said. The enemy will pay a price. That was October 7th. This is now day 32 of the war. Palestinian health officials say more than 10,000 people have been killed inside Gaza. Israeli tanks and troops are on the ground there. Over the past few days, UN officials say several thousand Palestinian civilians have evacuated Gaza City, heading to southern Gaza. Among them, resident Noor Naji Abu Nasser. Abu Nasser told the Associated Press that her journey to southern Gaza was terrifying and that she saw many dead bodies as she walked south. Four straight weeks of Israeli airstrikes have taken a toll on the civilian population, especially on children. This is how the United Nations chief Antonio Guterres described the situation at a press conference yesterday.
Gaza is becoming a graveyard for children,
with many more reportedly killed and injured every day. The World's Shirin Jafari reports, and a word of caution, details in the story may upset some listeners.
Children do not start conflicts, and they are powerless to stop them. Those were the words of Catherine Russell, another top UN official, at a Security Council meeting last month. Some 4,000 children have been killed by Israel in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run Ministry of Health. Israeli officials say 31 were killed by Hamas militants on October 7th, and about 20 of them remain hostage. Every day, there are disturbing images and videos coming out of Gaza. In this video, rescuers rush to carry a wounded girl out of a bombed-out building. She's lying on a stretcher, her face covered in dust, her hair disheveled, her body limp. Am I going to the grave? The girl asks the rescuers. You are alive and beautiful as the moon, one of them responds. But so many others have not been as lucky. Like this father, who is searching for his children under the rubble of a building using an axe and his bare hands. They're in heaven, my friend, the man filming the video tells the father. They're in heaven.
Our greatest fears were when this started, that, you know, we would see dozens of children killed and then it'd be hundreds and then suddenly there'd be thousands. These greatest fears were realized within a fortnight.
James Elder is the spokesperson for UNICEF. He says nearly half of the 2.2 million population in Gaza is under the age of 18, making it one of the youngest populations in the world. Even before the recent war, Elder explains, Gaza was far from an ideal place for a child to grow up. Children there have spent their whole lives cut off from the outside world, he says, because of the 16-year Israeli blockade.
You had around 800,000 children in Gaza who reported some kind of mental health problem, some kind of stress-related issue. 800,000, it's you know, 4 in 5 children.
Now the situation is even worse. Elder gives the example of one of his colleagues, Nesma, a mother of 2, a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. Her 4-year-old, Talia, he says, is showing signs of severe stress.
She's self-harming, she's ripping out her hair, she's scratching her thighs until they bleed. And her mum would understand well what trauma looks like. She works for UNICEF. And yet she simply said, I don't have the luxury to think about my children's mental health. I just keep telling myself, Nesma, keep them alive.
But keeping their children alive has become an almost impossible task for many parents in Gaza. Even if they survive airstrikes, they face hunger, lack of clean water and sanitation. All that while trying to make sense of the calamity around them.
The bombs and the bullets that the Israelis uses against individuals, it kills people physically, some people physically, but also it kills the others who survive emotionally and mentally.
Iman Farajullah is a clinical psychologist in the San Francisco Bay Area. She grew up in Gaza and moved to the U.S. 2 decades ago. Most of her family is still in Gaza.
My sisters are staying in the schools. My heart is aching and hurting. I'm almost like crying every day.
This is not the first time that Farajullah's family experiences violence at the hands of the Israelis, she says. Growing up in Gaza in the 1980s, she remembers her brothers being arrested, beaten, and taken away from her home. Some nights, she remembers, Israeli soldiers came to her neighborhood and she couldn't sleep.
And then it was like you sit there and you wait. Are they going to climb our door and our walls? And they're going to be in the house? Who are they going to be arresting? That is the childhood I lived.
Even though it's been 2 decades since she left Gaza, Farajullah says she still suffers from the trauma of those days. She says at the time there was no professional help available, and that's why she decided to become a psychologist. Farajullah has done research on the impact of repeated violence on children in Gaza. And she says many show behavioral, mental, and physical signs of stress. She gives me some examples.
Fear of darkness, flashbacks, nightmares, some kids even, and we're talking about even like 15 and 16 years old, who would not leave their mother's side. And even if they want to go to the bathroom or the kitchen during the night, they would not go unless their mom goes with them.
Exposure to repeated violence can have long-term impact on children, Farajullah says. She says the bombings need to stop, and then the children need access to mental health professionals on the ground who can help them make sense of the tragedy. Israeli children are also under mental and physical threat. At least 20 children were abducted by Hamas on October 7th and are believed to be in Gaza, including Aviv and Roz, who are 2 and 4.
Happy birthday to you! They're both sitting on the bed, singing me happy birthday while I was, I guess, at work or something. And
this is their father, Yoni Asher. He tells me that his wife, Doron, had taken the kids to visit her mother for the holiday. When the Hamas militants attacked their kibbutz, he says, they killed Doron's mother and her partner, and they took Doron and the kids hostage. Asher was in touch with his wife, but lost contact with her. It was only later that he saw a video of her on social media in the back of a cart being taken away by Hamas militants.
I'm very concerned about their condition, about what are they eating, what are they doing, are they in some kind of danger?
Asher says he hasn't been able to get any news of his daughters and his wife since their abduction. As each day passes, he gets more and more desperate. He says he wishes he could send a message to their abductors.
Let's trade. Give me back my family. Release them. Take me.
The war between Hamas and Israel has left a trail of destruction and devastation. And caught in the middle of all this are millions of children, some whose lives were cut short, and others who carry the scars for a long time.
The World's Shirin Jafari reporting there on how children are being affected by the war between Hamas and Israel. Shirin joins me now. There are aid groups who focus just on the needs of kids. What are they telling you?
That's right, Marco. Like all NGOs, they have to be very careful to avoid getting into politics and taking sides and just staying focused on getting access to the people and places that need help. I recently sat down with the head of Save the Children to learn more about how they are working in Gaza. Here's part of my conversation with CEO Yanti Shuripto. She told me what the situation looks like on the ground for children.
Most of the population now has moved to the south, as they were suggested, advised to do. So overcrowded shelters in a very small space. So with consistent, continuous violence and fighting, it is not a complete surprise that many, many civilian casualties will follow.
Have you been able to get supplies into Gaza?
We have. We were happy to hear that now three trucks from Save the Children have made it across the Rafah crossing over the past couple of days. We have more trucks waiting. We'd love to get them in too. And the other thing I would say, in order to distribute the supplies once they're in, we also need to have fuel. At the moment, we're literally using donkey carts in the south of Gaza to distribute supplies. We have staff taking supplies on their back to deliver supplies door to door or to distribution centers. But clearly that is not the fastest, most effective way to do distribution.
How are you negotiating getting more aid into Gaza? Are you talking with the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Israelis?
Look, the main negotiator here clearly is the international community, governments, US governments, the EU, others, right? We're, of course, doing our part to call for a ceasefire, to call for a humanitarian pause, to call for more trucks being allowed in, and not only trucks with supplies, but also to allow more humanitarian workers in. We do that privately. We have conversations with legislators here. Clearly, USAID is looking at that and also trying to influence that, as are other development and humanitarian agencies across the world.
I want to talk about the kids on the Israeli side as well. We know that a number of them are held hostage currently. What do you know about how they are doing?
It's horrible. Look, abduction, kidnapping of children is a grave violation of their rights. It's a crime. And those hostages have to be unconditionally released. Absolutely. The children and the adults, right? And that ought to be part of a pause in the fighting.
Have you been able to get any information about how they're doing?
Nothing. And that, you know, that is also not, you know, in the purview or in the mandate of humanitarian organizations. That negotiation is really happening at government level.
So let's imagine that there is a ceasefire tomorrow. What are some of the immediate needs of children in Gaza?
So then we would send in fresh, new, more humanitarian workers. We would send in medical care, more medical supplies. We would send in also, people always think, is that really the most important thing? And we think it is. Play and education materials for children. Give children the chance to be children, even for a little bit, every day. We set up child-friendly spaces and we get them to start to actually process some of that trauma. So that's where some of the mental health psychosocial support comes in. I visited Gaza a few years ago and I saw some of the work that we were doing there with play, through education, through role play, through counseling. Sports is an important part of that too. And I saw kids with hope. I'm always amazed. I get to see a lot of those kids in those circumstances. I'm always amazed by the amount of hope they still have. So it is possible to do it if we can get in there and do the work that we know needs to be done.
That was Yanti Shiripto, the CEO of Save the Children, speaking there with the world's Shirin Jafari. Shirin, extraordinary and kind of surprising to hear Yanti talk about hope.
Yeah, Marco, as hard as healing can seem at this point in the war, experts I talk to say this is possible. Children can heal from these experiences, but they need access to professional help and also a safe environment for that to happen.
Shirin, thanks very much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
The scrutiny of casualty numbers and death tolls in the Gaza war point to a larger problem of how information in a war zone is accurately reported. Our conversation on that is still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Russian President Vladimir Putin will run for re-election in March, according to reporting by Reuters. Putin has already been the de facto ruler of Russia since 1999. Re-election in March would keep him in office through 2030, a 40-year rule in a country where political oppression is increasingly suppressed. For as long as he's been in power, we in the West have tried to understand who Putin is exactly and what motivates him. There's a new 5-part podcast about Putin's life that offers some answers. About a Boy is from journalist Julia Yaffe. Yaffe begins a story a decade before Putin's birth and the devastation of the Second World War.
More than 27 million Soviet citizens died during the war. That's 15% of the country's population killed in just 4 years. Every family lost scores of people, whether it was fathers and sons or daughters killed on the battlefield.
An excerpt there from the podcast About a Boy, written and narrated by Julia Yaffe. So, Julia, World War II had ended 7 years before Vladimir Putin was born, but you devote the entire first episode to this dark and miserable backdrop in which Putin was born. Why is that so important?
Well, it's important because this was the thing that hung over Putin and his generation, the Soviet baby boomers, for their entire youth. Their parents, their grandparents had been through hell and back. The country had come out ravaged by this war. And it was just such an earth-shaking trauma for the entire country that they all grew up in its shadows.
And the fact that Putin was born in Leningrad, today St. Petersburg, the site of the fiercest battle and siege, some would say not just of World War II, but of military history, what does that mean for Putin?
I think what it means for Putin is that Russia can, A, have severe setbacks initially. The Soviet Union lost a tremendous amount of territory, a tremendous amount of people during the first year and a half of World War II. But then it was able to turn things around and push the Nazi invaders, not just from Soviet territory, but all the way back across Eastern Europe and ultimately to Berlin. So the lesson there for Putin, who I think has always wanted this kind of great military confrontation with the West, is that he can take a lot of hits and then come back and Russia can still win.
You talk a lot about in your podcast about life in the Soviet housing blocks and the courtyards known as the dvors, places that were communal. In these blocks, there were shared kitchens and bathrooms, no privacy. I want us to hear another clip from your podcast where the Russian-American journalist Andrew Rifkin tells you about the rules of behavior in these courtyards, the dvors.
You would have these, like, some basic rules, like you don't hit a girl, you can't pick on those who are younger than you. If your dvor goes to fight against another dvor, you have to participate, you have to fight. If you don't, and, you know, you chicken out of a fight, then your social reputation is gone because you're considered weak.
Julia, spell out for us how these rules of the dvor help shape young Vladimir Putin.
Well, they shaped him and they shaped members of his generation who were, again, born to these haunted, deeply traumatized parents who were working long hours, and their kids grew up largely in the Dvor, where these rules based on physical dominance, on fierce loyalty, this was how they came to understand human nature and human relationships. This episode grew out of my conversations with my father, who is a few years younger than Vladimir Putin, but grew up in a Dvor and a blue-collar neighborhood, much like Vladimir Putin's. And when I asked my father, you know, what was more important, more formative to you in terms of learning how to, you know, manage people in a workplace? Was it your MBA or the rules in the Dvor? And he said, definitely the Dvor.
In later episodes of About a Boy, your podcast, you move us into the early 1990s. Putin has been working for the KGB. How did his instinct for survival serve him during this really chaotic time?
It served him in two ways. The first is that he learned from the Dvor that you have to find the biggest guy, the guy with the most physical power and the most political power in the yard, and kind of cozy up to him and serve him with tremendous loyalty. And he did that in kind of sidling up to Anatoly Sobchak, who was the first democratically elected mayor of the post-communist St. Petersburg. And the second way was that in a city that was almost entirely run by organized crime, a lot of these mobsters came from similar backgrounds that he did, from these dvors, and spoke a similar language, had the same worldview, saw the same rules of the game, and Putin was able to communicate and work with them.
Right. I mean, as you point out, this is a short, scrawny kid from a poor neighborhood in Leningrad. And we move into the 2000s, and suddenly Putin is prime minister, then president, the ruler of 11 time zones. But he comes onto the world stage. He's careful, as he would be in the Dvor. Can you talk about one thing briefly that you underscore in the podcast, what Putin's reaction was to the U.S. invasion of Iraq under George W. Bush, and the path, as you see it, that sent Putin down?
It showed him that this is something you can do, that if you become powerful enough, you can do this. You can make your own rules of the Dvor. You can muscle your way through, even if other powerful players in the courtyard don't like what you're doing.
Julia, coming now to Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, here's a clip from your last chapter in the podcast. This is Russian investigative journalist Yevgenia Albats.
He believes that he can wait and see. He keeps killing Ukrainians. Americans keep supplying weapons. He's running this war of attrition until everybody gets tired, everybody gets preoccupied, and he just have to wait until the other side gets tired, and then he will attack with full force.
Again, Julia, I mean, it seems the rules of the Dvor, this childhood courtyard of Putin's, seem to apply here. What do you think that means for Putin's next steps in Ukraine?
It seems the words of Yevgenia Albats were quite prescient, because we recorded the podcast right before the war between Israel and Hamas. And we can see already Putin reveling in the fact that the West and the rest of the world are now preoccupied with what happens in Israel-Palestine. And you can see him using the cover of another conflict that's distracting the United States and the West to keep pushing forward in Ukraine.
I mean, the world is distracted right now, but has the absence of an immediate victory put Putin's kind of courtyard bullying in check at this point?
No, I don't think it has. I think Putin, again, thinking about World War II, about thinking about the rules of the Dvor, I think he believes that he cannot step back. He has put it all on the table. He has declared what he wants to do, which is to conquer Ukraine, dismantle its government, erase it off the map as a sovereign, independent country. He can't back down from that. If you say it, you have to do it. If you say it and you back down, you smell of weakness. And it won't even be that the Ukrainians will defeat him. It'll be his own elites that will turn on him if they sense that he is no longer the strong, dominant figure in the Dvor, keeping them all in check. Because of this, I think he sees himself as painted into a corner. And if you're in a corner, the only way to go is forward, all out.
Journalist Julia Yaffe, her five-part podcast About a Boy is out now. Terrific work, Julia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. There's a shipwreck off the coast of Colombia, a 300-year-old Spanish galleon.
It's like people regularly call the shipwrecks time capsules, and I'm not a big fan of the metaphor.
Because in this case, the ship is believed to be full of treasure worth billions of dollars. Sunken treasure still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's only been 4 weeks, but in that time, the news from Israel's war with Gaza has been intense. The bombardment, the deaths and injuries, the lack of daily necessities, water, medicine, food, communications down. It has been relentless and grim. When it comes to reporting on what's happening inside the Gaza Strip, that's also been dangerous business. More than 30 Palestinian journalists have been killed. So far, for the most part, foreign reporters have not been allowed into Gaza. But like any conflict, it's vital for newsrooms to get the story right from all angles. Sharif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa program coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's in Washington. Let's start with safety, Sharif. 30 journalists killed in Gaza. How dangerous is it to work there right now?
This is unprecedented level of risk, exponential risk. We have not seen that many journalists killed in 1 month in any other conflict we've covered for 3 decades. In so many ways, the risks are against journalists in Gaza because majority of them are local freelance who had no other choice. They were on the front line. They are the most needed right now, but they are also the most vulnerable. They don't have access to protection equipment, but they don't have a safe haven or exit. They all have had to flee, and now they are struggling to find an internet connection or electricity to be able to connect it to the world.
Do we know how many of those journalists were killed and whether the parties responsible will be held to account for those deaths?
Well, majority of the journalists were killed in Gaza, 31 out of 37 or so. And they are, for the most part, were killed in bombardment, Israeli army airstrike. In the early days, there were a few who were killed with Israeli army bullets while covering clashes on October 7. And the reason why this has been the most risky, a lot of the journalists have tried to flee, and many of them continue to work or continue to pay this heavy toll. But they continue to try and work with international media who don't have access inside the country, so serving as basically eyewitnesses.
What threat does Hamas itself pose to journalists inside Gaza?
Well, at the beginning of the conflict, at least four Israeli journalists were killed by Hamas fighters in southern Israel. And they were the first Israeli journalists killed since 1999. And in some ways, before this conflict, they have enforced their own censorship about who gets to report from within Gaza. But even Israeli and international journalists were advised by Israeli government and the Israeli army not to enter Gaza before this conflict starts.
Yeah, so what have you heard about foreign journalists getting into the Gaza Strip? Do you expect that to happen sooner rather than later?
We are hoping, but we are very alarmed to have heard the Israeli government say more than a week ago that they cannot guarantee the safety of Reuters, AFP, and other international media. And this, in addition to other harassment and hostile environment, arrests, censorship that's being done in the West Bank and in Israel, unprecedented, makes our worry even more.
As far as the safety of foreign journalists, is that a problem that has a solution? I mean, couldn't they inform the IDF where they are so they don't get hit with airstrikes?
We call on the Israeli army to make public and be transparent with their rules of engagements, especially when it has to do with journalists. And we have called on the U.S. government and other Israeli allies to raise publicly with their Israeli counterparts the need for them to reform those rules of engagements to add more safeguards to journalists.
So the IDF led some reporters through one area of their operation last weekend. But what are your concerns without this full kind of spectrum media coverage of what's happening inside Gaza?
Well, the unprecedented casualty toll and the harassment and the hostile environment, coupled with the communication blackout, makes this basically a news blackout that has severe consequences worldwide, not just for the people involved on the warring party sides, but for hundreds of millions around the world who are watching and trying to learn and understand the motivations of the warring parties and the implications of their policies.
So, Sharif, as someone who works to protect journalists and by extension protect the truth, what has it felt like for you to watch this war unfold?
It's heartbreaking. You know, everyone has been impacted by this war. I've been documenting Gaza war since 2012 for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And to see that toll have already doubled over the course of 4 weeks compared to 21 years. It has been hard. It's tough. It's something that me and my colleagues have been struggling with, of course. But I think the best we can do is to continue to document this and keep our head down and tell the story.
Sharif Mansour is with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Sharif, thank you very much for talking this all through with us.
Thank you for having me.
The British Home Secretary says that homelessness is often a lifestyle choice. Suella Braverman is one of the UK's most senior ministers. She's posted controversially on social media that Britain must not allow its streets to be taken over by rows of tents occupied by people, many of whom come from abroad. She went on to warn that British cities could go the way of places like San Francisco and Los Angeles. Those comments have brought a huge backlash from charities in the UK that attend to the homeless, as we hear from the World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry.
Peter Krikant knows what it's like to be homeless in Britain.
I spent a number of years on the streets that started in my late teens and my early 20s.
Krikant, who was born in Falkirk outside Glasgow in Scotland, tells me he had a difficult childhood. In school, he says, teachers called him quarrelsome and unhappy, but they never asked him why. And before he reached his teens, he says, he had already started experimenting with drugs.
I was making decisions as young as 11 and 12 to consume alcohol and other types of drugs. By the time I reached my late teens, things in my life had got uncontrollable.
Krikant says it took him years to get his life back on track. Today, he works for a social justice charity called Cranston that helps people with addiction issues. Out of the hundreds of people he has met living on the streets over the years, he says, he can think of maybe only one man who might have made the choice to be there. Suella Braverman, the British Home Secretary, has described homelessness as a lifestyle choice. She's considering fining charities who give tents to those who are sleeping rough.
It cannot be right that parts of our cities are ruined and blighted by the sight and use of tents. There is no need to use tents for accommodation in 21st century Britain. It brings criminality, it brings drug use, it brings, in many instances, violence to communities.
There are around 3,000 people living rough on the streets of Britain today, although it's estimated that in the last year alone, more than 100,000 families are at risk of homelessness. John Hamblin, who runs a charity called Shekinah in Plymouth in the southwest of England, says he's never seen the numbers so high. He says the cost of living crisis has made things all the harder, and there's not enough new social housing being built. Hamblin's charity does give out tents to those who sleep rough, he says, but only as a last resort.
If we come across people that are out sleeping rough and they are out in the open, it would make perfect sense to me that rather than leave them in the open, you give them some form of shelter, but done with a heavy heart, because we don't want to see people sleeping in tents either. That's not right in 2023.
Hamlin says there are many reasons why people end up living on the streets, but he says one factor comes up time and again.
80 to 90% of those people, it's probably about childhood trauma. And we know that people often have kind of quite poor mental health issues, but a lot of that will be linked back to unresolved issues of childhood trauma in their life. And that's a common thing.
Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, said she wants to see the government take action before UK cities end up like San Francisco or LA, where, she said, there's an explosion of crime, drug taking and squalor. Sam Tsambaris has been working in the field of homelessness in the US for decades. He says he can't quite believe a senior British politician is saying things he heard US lawmakers say more than 40 years ago.
One of the reasons that we ended up in such a bad state with homelessness in the United States is that there were people in very influential positions in office, in political office, that were saying absurd things like people are homeless by choice. You know, notably, people like Ronald Reagan said that.
Tsambaris, who lives in LA, runs Housing First programs across the US. And he says there is a simple way to solve homelessness.
The solution to not having tent cities is to expand the access and the production of social housing, which is desperately needed. You know, the solution to homelessness is housing. It's not actually that complicated.
Suella Braverman's proposal to crack down on homeless charities giving out tents was expected to be formally announced in Parliament today. But so far, there's been no mention of the plan. John Hamblin with homeless charity Shekinah says maybe it's a sign that common sense has prevailed. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The civil war in Myanmar may be turning a corner. A pro-democratic resistance has accelerated its mission to topple the country's military regime, which seized power in a coup 2.5 years ago. A new offensive by the armed resistance is pushing the regime out of cities, seizing its weapons, even capturing a brand new bridge built by China. The World's Patrick Nguyen says pro-democratic forces are now more hopeful than ever. He's closely following the story. Patrick, refresh us on the situation in Myanmar and the various armed groups fighting against the military junta.
Well, in Myanmar, there are three seasons. There's a hot season, a monsoon season, and a dry season, which just started. And dry season also has another name, fighting season, because when the rain stops, it's time to fight in earnest. And who's doing the fighting? Well, it's the military regime fighting with brutal force against many different ethnic minorities based in the mountains, in the borderlands. There are more than a dozen indigenous groups with their own armed resistance forces. And in more recent times, also Myanmar's lowlanders are also in the fight. These are people in the plains and the cities who are mostly ethnic Burmese, like the military's leaders. But they're fed up with them, too, after the regime seized power from an elected government in 2021, and they've imposed a vicious police state since then. So the entire country is on fire, and there's an armed resistance from the lowlands to the highlands, and they've struggled and suffered for 2.5 years. But going into this new fighting season, they're seeing some pretty big successes.
So what is at stake in the civil war?
The future of Myanmar. And the resistance has fought very hard to achieve these pretty staggering gains. They've seized a big chunk of the border with China, even taking over a brand new suspension bridge built by China's government. That's a big deal. Resistance fighters are now running border crossings where billions of dollars of trade flows through. And some regime troops in those areas are just surrendering. A whole battalion just switched sides. And this operation has range, too. It's also taken over a zone closer to the heartland of the country, away from the border. And there are these videos online of ecstatic townsfolk rushing out to meet convoys of fighters who are liberating their towns. So that's a city called Khao Lin. People inside Myanmar who I spoke to today are saying this operation is the worst nightmare of the regime because the lowlanders and highlanders are overcoming all of their differences, their racial differences, and coordinating their attacks against the military.
So what's been the international reaction to this? I mean, we know the U.S. has been critical of the junta from day one and supports the pro-democracy side. And then there's China, which is known to actually arm Myanmar's military regime.
So I'll start with the U.S. The U.S. will condemn the atrocities of Myanmar's military and impose sanctions. There's actually some new sanctions this week against the state oil and gas sector. But that's about as far as they'll go. The White House is pretty distracted these days for reasons that are quite obvious. China is more mercurial, so it will sell weapons and even fighter jets to the military, but it also has these backdoor relationships with some of the ethnic resistance forces, especially the ones on the Chinese border. Somehow, Chinese-made rifles end up in their hands, and so that's open to interpretation, but China seems to want to back the winning horse, whoever that may be. And then there's Russia also. Russia is the Myanmar military's closest ally, and Russia unapologetically sends them weapons, jets, armored carriers, training even, but Russia now has its hands full in Ukraine. So you can see the way geopolitics is shaping the outcome of what's happening in Myanmar and causing the regime leaders to feel pretty isolated.
Right, but what is the headline here, Patrick? Is Myanmar's ruling military facing defeat?
Not yet. What this means is that they are increasingly hollowed out and stretched thin and surrounded. And just to be clear, the resistance is a blanket term for dozens of armed groups that are not under one common leader or command. It's pretty messy. But if this operation this week is a trial run and they can continue to fuse together and stage even bigger offensives, that does not bode well for the military. It could spell their defeat at some point in the next 6 months, 12 months, who knows? And that would lead to the birth of a very different Myanmar.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for this update on what's happening in Myanmar, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Sunken treasure. There is some $20 billion worth of gold, silver, and emeralds sitting off the coast of Colombia in a centuries-old Spanish shipwreck. The ship is called the San Jose and was rediscovered in 2015. Different groups have laid claim to the treasure that's thought to be on board. Most notably, the Colombian government is now saying it has launched a mission to raise the wreck. Ricardo Borrero is an investigator with the Colombian Institute of Anthropology and History. He joins us from Bogota. Let's start first with the story of the San Jose, Ricardo. How and when exactly did it end up at the bottom of the Caribbean?
Well, it was all during the succession war for the throne of Spain. The galleon went from Cartagena to Portobelo for the fair. And in its way back to Cartagena, the British were hunting the ships and they got engaged in a battle which is called the Battle of Barú. And they opened fire against the San Jose, and there was a fire in the San Jose galleon, and it sunk to an undisclosed depth. And this is all the conflict that framed the sinking of the San Jose, and which was an international conflict among European powers.
Yeah, colonial battle for territory, really. What do we know about the treasure still on the San Jose? What does the ship actually contain?
Well, the ship may contain many, many merchandises coming from Asia, coming from Africa, and of course, coming from America. It's like people regularly call the shipwrecks time capsules, and I'm not a big fan of the metaphor. But in any case, it has goods and coming from all the continents. It testifies for the story of the first globalization of the world, I would argue. So beyond the merchandises and the cargo, it may contain also personal possessions of the crew and the passengers, which is just like a small floating city containing as much as you need to survive and to survive under movements to survive at sea.
Now, for a long time, the location of the shipwreck of the San Jose was unknown. Who exactly made the discovery in 2015?
Well, there were attempts since the moment it sunk, but probably like the most serious attempts started back in the 80s. When a treasure hunting company argued they have found the ship. But back in 2015, the Colombian government, with help of some others, they located the wreck using an AUV and the actual location of the wreck.
Yeah, AUV, that's like an underwater drone, a marine drone. So today, Ricardo, who are the different parties claiming this treasure?
there's the interest of the treasure hunting companies that have been involved in the search for the San Jose, and they have the right. There's the claims of the Black Afro-descendant communities arguing that what the precious cargo carried on board was mined using enslaved African labor. It's claimed as well by the indigenous communities of Bolivia, and where apparently the silver was mined. It's claimed by Spain because they argue it's a flagship, a war vessel. And of course, definitively by the Colombian government because it lies sunken in Colombian territorial waters.
In your opinion, does any one of these parties have a stronger claim over the treasure than the others?
You know, as it's a galleon and testify for the first globalized world, it should be taken as world heritage, and international cooperation should prevail in the study, always keeping in mind it's not a treasure, it's just heritage. Maybe it's just a treasure because the amount of information it can provide about the colonial past.
After several hundred years, Ricardo, the wreck, I imagine, is going to be really fragile, and raising it and the treasure could be a long, painstaking process. The Colombian government says it's aiming to retrieve this undersea treasure by 2026. Do you think that's realistic?
If it's risen and if it's brought to the surface and the proper conservation treatments are not taken, all's going to be lost. They're going to lose the equilibrium they have right now with the environment. And thus, it requires very complex and expensive interventions. So maybe the decision to take it out, it's an ill-advised decision.
You take this very scientific view, Ricardo. Are you curious at all about taking a dive and seeing what's going on with the San Jose?
So the only way to visit it would be either using ROVs, the remote operated vehicles, and AUVs that are the ones that have been used so far. But yeah, definitely, of course, it's a wonderful opportunity to learn about history, to check what was going on at that point. It's definitely a tempting idea.
Ricardo Barrero is an investigator with the Colombian Institute of Anthropology and History. He joined us from Bogota. Thank you very much for being with us, Ricardo, and sharing what you know.
Thanks for inviting me.
This morning, just before noon, King Charles III delivered the King's Speech, an annual address that marks the start of the new session of Britain's Parliament. Charles's mother delivered the address 67 times. The last time the King's Speech was delivered by an actual king was in 1950.
Escorted by a sovereign's escort of the household cavalry and riding...
Then and now, the event was accompanied by pomp and ceremony, informed by centuries of British history. This morning, the King's Guard, a kind of medieval secret service, drew up their ranks in front of Buckingham Palace. Meanwhile, across town at Westminster, the yeomen of the Guard made a ceremonial search of the cellars underneath Parliament. This tradition dates back to 1605, when the anti-monarchist Guy Fawkes plotted to blow up Parliament and the King. With their own security assured, King Charles III and Queen Camilla began the mile-and-a-half ride to Westminster in their royal carriage. Inside the House of Lords, King Charles and Queen Camilla sat on gilded thrones. They dispatched one of the lords, a lady, to invite the House of Commons next door to come into the Lord's chamber. She carried a long ebony stick known as the Black Rod. She returned with the Prime Minister and a parade of politicians from the lower house, and per tradition, the door was slammed in her face. She banged three times with the rod, and the House of Commons crowded in to hear the King's speech.
My lords and members of the House of Commons.
Now, the King's speech is not written by the King. It's written by the Prime Minister. That is the tradition. It's like our State of the Union address, laying out the government's agenda for the next year. But instead of reading it himself, the Prime Minister has the King as his spokesman. This year's King's speech might have been a challenge for Charles, who's known as an environmentalist.
This bill will support the future licensing of new oil and gas fields.
21 such bills were packed into the King's speech by Rishi Sunak, the Conservative Prime Minister, setting his own agenda in a politically volatile year. King Charles delivered all of them with an unemotional and regal tone, and with that, the King and Queen left the building. On their carriage ride home, people lined the streets hoping for a glimpse of the royal couple, and there were others.
And here we go, the boos are starting now.
Booing crowds, not normally part of the King's speech, which just shows that even in a monarchy, the people will have their say. That is our show on this Tuesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.